From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The book Seabiscuit is back on top of the bestseller list, it's been adapted into a new movie, and it spawned a couple of TV documentaries. But the woman who created this phenomenon, writer Laura Hillenbrand, often barely has the strength to get out of bed. For 16 years, she's had an extreme case of chronic fatigue syndrome. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with her about why she wrote the book and how she managed to do it. Why would an editor take a chance on someone who is so sick? We'll ask her editor, Jonathan Karp. He also edited the book The Orchid Thief, which is adapted into the film adaptation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The California Assembly has approved a compromise budget designed to cope with the state's record budget deficit. Governor Gray Davis has indicated that he'll sign the measure, which would cut spending, raise fees, and borrow to cover a projected $38 billion spending gap. The compromise brings an end to a month-long battle between Democrats, who favored a combination of spending cuts and tax increases, and Republicans, who oppose tax hikes in any form. Critics said the budget simply puts off a fiscal crisis that's likely to return again next summer. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon visited the White House today, where he told reporters that Israel will continue to build a controversial security barrier that cuts through the West Bank. But Sharon says Israel will try to do it in a way that has minimal impact on the lives of Palestinians. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
President Bush has called the construction of the barrier a problem in efforts to make peace between Israel and the Palestinians. But the president says he understands the sensitivity of the security issue among Israelis. At a White House news conference, Mr. Bush said discussions of the fence will continue. Sharon said Israel is prepared to make more concessions in the interests of peace, but he said Israel expects more from the Palestinians than the current ceasefire.
We are concerned that this welcome quiet will be shattered any minute as a result of the continued existence of terror organizations which the Palestinian Authority is doing nothing to eliminate or dismantle.
President Bush also made it clear that he expects the Palestinians to do more to crack down on militant groups. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Republicans failed once again today to break a Democratic filibuster of President Bush's nomination of Texas Judge Priscilla Owen to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Owen vote was the first of four cloture votes the Republican leadership has scheduled this week on judicial nominees in an effort to point out what Republican senators call obstructionism by the Democrats. But the Democrats counter that they have confirmed 140 Bush judicial nominees and are filibustering only four, in contrast to the Republicans who the Democrats contend during the Clinton administration prevented votes on 60 Clinton judicial nominees. The vote on the Owen nomination today was 53-43, seven short of the 60 needed to break a filibuster. It was the eighth time the GOP has fallen short, failing to add even one vote on Owen and on another appeals court nominee, Miguel Estrada. Later this week, cloture votes are expected on Estrada and two other controversial appeals court nominees, Alabama's William Pryor and California's Carolyn Kuhl. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 62 points to close at 9,204. The NASDAQ was down 4 at 1731. This is NPR News. The funeral was held today for the New York City councilman who was gunned down at City Hall last week. About 200 people packed into the church to pay their last respects to Councilman James E. Davis. Letitia Theodore reports from member station WNYC.
The three-hour-long service was a colorful tribute to a man who was remembered as such. The base of the pulpit was lined with wreaths. Speakers included Mayor Michael Bloomberg, with a eulogy delivered by presidential hopeful, the Reverend Al Sharpton. New York Congressional Representative Charles Rangel recalled Davis's message of anti-violence and urged everyone to continue that work.
We got a rough time in this country, in this state and city, but James has set a standard for all of us. I thank God that I got a chance to call him a friend.
Davis's casket was draped with the American flag and carried outside by honor guards. The mayor presented the councilman's mother with that flag. A crowd of more than 100 people followed the hearse. For NPR News, I'm Letitia Theodore, in New York.
A Los Angeles jury said today that it was hopelessly deadlocked in the case of a former police officer accused of assaulting a teenager during a videotaped arrest. The judge declared a mistrial in the case of former officer Jeremy Morse. The jury said it was split 7-5, with the majority believing that Morse was guilty of using unnecessary force against Donovan Jackson. The jury found Morse's former partner, Bijan Darvish, not guilty of filing a false report that failed to mention the violence. Morse is white and Jackson is black. The arrest in July of last year was videotaped by a bystander in the largely black city of Inglewood, where city officials have been campaigning to prevent violence. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The book Seabiscuit is back on top of the bestseller list. It inspired the new film of the same name, as well as a couple of TV documentaries. It was written by a woman who often barely has the strength to leave her bed. Author Laura Hillenbrand has been living with an extreme case of chronic fatigue syndrome for the past 16 years. We called her at her home to talk with her about why she devoted whatever strength she did have to the story of a horse. By the way, there's a new illustrated edition of the book Seabiscuit that includes about 150 photographs from archives and private collections. Well, Laura, welcome to Fresh Air. Apparently, you were just at the White House watching a preview of the movie with the president. Did you ever think that the Seabiscuit story would become such a phenomenon?
I don't think any writer expects this kind of success. Everybody has wild dreams, but mine didn't reach this far. I did know that the horse was absolutely wildly popular in the 1930s, and I thought that the same things that appealed to Americans in the 1930s could appeal to them today, and most notably the fact that he's a wonderful underdog and the people around him were wonderful underdogs.
What made them underdogs?
Everyone in this story, these are all very different individuals, the three men and the horse, but all of them emerged from loss. The horse's owner had brought the automobile to the West and become a multimillionaire, and then his son was killed in an automobile accident, and that's what turned him to horses. The trainer was a man who'd spent 60 years out on the Mustang ranges breaking Mustangs and had become obsolete when the horse was driven out by the automobile. And the jockey was abandoned at a racetrack as a boy and had been living in a horse stall for 12 years before he found Seabiscuit. And these guys were very, very different individuals in personality as well as history, but they recognized the strengths in each other, and together they really created a beautiful partnership that worked very well and brought the world a great racehorse.
Of course, the horse himself was an underdog. What made Seabiscuit an underdog or an underhorse?
He was a horse who, he was pretty well-bred, not very well-bred, but he was very homely. He was badly put together. His knees didn't straighten all the way, so it looked like he was always in the process of kneeling down. His tail was too short. His head was too big. His legs were too short. And he had just no success as a racehorse for the first 2 years of his career. He was, in fact, so bad that his owner tried to give him away as a polo pony, and the man she offered him to turned him down. He really was coming from the bottom of the sport and trying to work his way up to the top, and he needed these men to do it. His first trainer simply didn't understand him.
Now, you have a very extreme case of chronic fatigue syndrome, which has left you unable to leave your bed for long periods of time. There have been periods when it's interfered with your cognitive abilities, your ability to think, read, or speak. You've had this for years. You had it when you started writing Seabiscuit. You still have it now. In your compromised state, why, of all the subjects in the world, was it Seabiscuit that you decided to invest whatever energy you had?
This story gave me the ability to climb out of my body and into the bodies of these wonderful, vigorous individuals living in a fascinating time, and individuals who succeeded in overcoming the things that were against them, which I've not been able to do. My physical life is very, very difficult because of this illness, but I think I identified with all of them, but I think the one I identified with most was jockey Red Pollard, Seabiscuit's jockey, because his body was the obstacle between himself and achieving what he wanted to achieve. He was too tall to be a jockey. He really didn't suit it in his mind, really. He was a man who in another era probably would have become a professor. He was a tremendously erudite man. And he was horribly accident-prone. He was actually blinded in one eye in a racing accident, and over the course of this story is hideously injured twice and spends a year of this story in a hospital bed, dwindling down to 86 pounds. And I identified with him. I understood how he must have felt in lying in that bed and watching his horse run without him. I think he and I have a lot in common, and he was probably the main reason I invested myself so much into this story, to the point of becoming kind of obsessed with it.
Well, were there ways that he handled himself when he was very sick or injured that made you think about your own like mental attitude toward your body?
He was someone who was very inspiring because he just kept pushing himself to do what he wanted in spite of everything, in spite of physical pain and the derision of his peers and the other people in the sport. And I drew a lot of strength from that. I felt very strongly for Red. He really probably never should have been a jockey. He probably should have been something else. He didn't have a great deal of talent. But you have to admire a man who is so free of everyone's opinions and even of his own body that he's capable of pulling himself along until he succeeds at it. He's a tremendously inspiring man. I'd like to be more like him.
You know, from your book, it sounds like a lot of jockeys are basically at war with their own bodies during their career because they're supposed to be, what, like 114 pounds. So they starve themselves. Some of them have anorexia, or at least this is how it was in the Seabiscuit era. Laxatives, you say that water is like the biggest enemy of the jockey because it weighs so much. So a lot of the jockeys are dehydrated.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about some of the things that you learned about the extreme regime that many jockeys were on then, and is it still that way?
Sure. It was definitely worse in the 1930s because there was less understanding of dieting and such, and there was also, there was no insurance for jockeys and things like that. But there's a paradox to being a jockey. You have to be tremendously strong to handle a 1,200-pound animal moving at 45 miles an hour, but you have to be extremely light. Racehorses are assigned the weights they carry in races, and the jockey is part of that weight. In the 30s, that weight could be as low as 86 pounds, and a jockey would then have to weigh about 2 pounds less than that to be able to have the saddle and his crop. And things that they did to get within that weight limit included burying themselves in the track manure pit, which was fermenting, so it was hot, and they would sweat off weight. They would wrap themselves in woolen horse blankets and run around and around the track in Mexican heat to sweat weight off. They would drink as little as possible. The jockey's valets would take ice picks and puncture a hole in the top of a soda can and drink out of it that way so that they could only have a few drops at a time. And these men deprived themselves of so much that some of them were hallucinating. They would be boosted into the saddle and fall right off the other side. Bulimia, anorexia were very, very common among jockeys. And it was things that people did not understand and weren't sympathetic to. On top of that, it's a very, very dangerous job. Between 1935 and 1939 alone, 19 jockeys were killed in racing accidents. So they put up with a great deal to do what they did, but the trade-off was they got a chance to ride God's most impressive athletic engine around a racetrack, and I think the thrill of that was worth all of it to them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Laura Hillenbrand, who's the author of the bestseller Seabiscuit, which has just been adapted into a movie. There's also a new edition of her book. It's a special illustrated edition with photographs of the period and of Seabiscuit and all the men who worked with him. You write that Seabiscuit had to be taught to love racing. That made me think, like, well, what's in it for the horse? You know, the horse doesn't understand medals, and it doesn't understand championships and publicity and money. So what's in it for the horse?
I think it's not exactly that Seabiscuit or other horses have to be taught to love racing. I think in Seabiscuit's case, his head got kind of turned around backwards because he was so mishandled by his first trainer. He forgot the natural love of running that all horses, especially thoroughbreds, have. If you go to a thoroughbred breeding farm, you'll see groups of horses, even just little foals, that will run flat out for long periods every day racing each other. It's been bred into them for 300 years, and they thrill at it. They absolutely love to do this. I've seen horses many, many times lose their riders in the middle of races and then run the race exactly as if a rider was on their back, trying to win it. And I think in Seabiscuit's case, he was whipped very heavily. He was mistreated. He was not an understood animal in his first barn, and he became very obstreperous. And what Tom Smith, his second trainer, did for him is stop forcing him to do anything and allow him to rediscover how much he loved to run. I think racehorses, as I said, they've been bred for 300 years to love winning, and they do. You will see a physical difference in a horse who's won a race versus a horse who's lost it. They swagger. They seem to be showing off and strutting their stuff out there when they win.
What are some of the things that you think Tom Smith understood about how to work with a troubled horse?
Well, I think, for one thing, he was capable of recognizing that the horse was troubled. He was a guy, people would call him a horse whisperer today. He was a man who'd spent 60 years out following Mustangs around the West, and he understood horses very deeply. And he could go into a horse's stall, and he would sit down and sit there for several hours just squatting next to the horse watching him. And he'd come out understanding that horse's mind. And he could read the very subtle gestures that horses make when they're indicating that something is wrong, and he knew how to remedy those things. And he understood that a happy racehorse is a winning racehorse. And so the big focus of his training technique was to enable a horse to be very comfortable around the people who would ride him and handle him, so that the horse could feel relaxed and run for the fun of it. And that's what he did with Seabiscuit. When he got Seabiscuit used to throw himself around the starting gate. He was afraid of it. He would really raise hell in there. And what Tom did was, one day he took the horse out to the gate and went into the gate with him and stood right under his chin. And when the horse acted up, Tom would just tap him on the chest until the horse stopped. And when the horse stopped, he'd stop tapping. And they stood in there for something like 2 hours. And by the end of it, the horse was completely relaxed. He never fought in the starting gate again. He understood it was a safe place to be.
How are racehorses treated in the Seabiscuit era compared to how they're treated now by their owners and their trainers?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm a good person to ask for a comparison, just because I haven't been around day-to-day horses in recent years on the racetrack. But the 1930s were a comparatively very good time for racing horses, in that in the earlier decades of the century, drug use was very common. Horses were being given cocaine and heroin and such to make them run faster, and races were very, very roughly run, very dangerously run. It was a pretty dirty sport in the first few years of the century, and that had been cleaned up a great deal, in part because during the Depression, state governments got involved in racing. They began to take a portion of betting revenue to support their staggering economies during the Depression. And in order to make a deal with governments to re-legalize racing after racing had been banned in a lot of places because of the corruption, racing cleaned up its act. And so you saw a lot fewer drugs being used on horses and things like that. I think it's my personal opinion that trainers were probably a little bit better than they are now. They apprenticed for a lot longer, and I think they understood horses a little bit better than people do today, with some noteworthy exceptions.
My guest is Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller Seabiscuit. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Laura Hillenbrand. She's joining us by phone from her home, and she's the author of the bestseller Seabiscuit, which has just been adapted into a new movie, and there's a new edition of the book that's an illustrated edition. You know, I don't have horses and I don't ride horses, but they're certainly magnificent animals. And you know, I do have a cat, and I like it when the cat sits on my lap. And it often makes me think, imagine what it's like to actually sit on the horse. You know, if it's so pleasing to have a cat on your lap, imagine what it's like to, like, sit on a horse and ride, and the kind of relationship that you could actually have with a horse when you ride the horse regularly and you know the horse well. Do you think about that a lot, about the closeness between a rider and the horse? You know, the closeness that Red Pollard must have had with Seabiscuit.
Yeah. Before I got sick, I was a passionate rider myself, and I had a few horses that I really bonded with and understood very well. And you get a kind of communion going with a horse where it's understood between you that you will take care of the horse and you will make the proper decisions and he will let you ride him. And a lot of horses really love being ridden and can't wait to get out and do things with their owners. And certainly the horses I had expressed that kind of feeling. And I write about this in the book because when you look at the way jockeys lived in the 1930s with the injuries they were suffering and what they were putting their bodies through to do this sport, it seems inexplicable that anyone would want to do it. Red Pollard, Seabiscuit's jockey, actually apparently swallowed tapeworm tablets so that he could keep at low weight, and he would check himself into a hospital to have the tapeworm removed when he became too malnourished. I mean, it's a bad life, but from talking to these guys, it's a trade-off, and I think what it is people are infatuated with freedom, especially Americans, and we are encumbered by our bodies. We're kind of slow, we're kind of sluggish, we're kind of small. A horse is this tremendous athletic engine. It's so fast. It has much faster reflexes than a man. Without a rider on its back, it can probably do well over 50 miles an hour. It's really a tremendous engine, and I think the trade-off is the jockey gets to wed his mind and his desire to the body of this animal, and it's absolutely thrilling, and that's the feeling I get from talking to these jockeys as to why they put themselves through this.
Now, I'm interested in your own background with horses. I think your father had some horses when you were growing up?
We had a farm, which my father still has, up near the Antietam battlefield, and the family had a kind of standing agreement with people in the county that if they had horses they didn't want or they didn't know what to do with, they could leave the horses at this farm, which had cattle on it, so it had open pasture that was good for horses. And all sorts of motley horses showed up, horses from the Humane Society and a Chincoteague pony with founder, and it really was a motley crew, but my sister and I would go out and ride them, and it was a real pleasure to do.
So did you ride for speed? And
A bit for speed, yeah. I had a horse who was a quarter horse, who that's the fastest breed. They can, even with a rider on their back, go up to 54 miles an hour. And I certainly did a bit of that. I'm not quite as brave as a jockey would be, but I think riding was the most pleasurable experience of my youth.
How much did you already know about Seabiscuit when you decided to write this book?
When I was about 7 years old, there was a little fair at an elementary school across the street from my house. It was held every May, and I walked over there 1 year, and they were selling used books, and I found a children's book called Come On, Seabiscuit, which was just wonderful. And I read it so many times, I broke the spine, and all the pages fell out. And I still have it. It has to be wrapped in rubber bands because the pages will go everywhere. But that, in just vivid prose, told the story of the horse. It didn't talk that much about the people, but I certainly knew about the horse, and he kind of hung around the back of my head until adulthood, and then in 1996 I was going through some documents on racing and came across information about the owner and the trainer and the jockey and realized that this story had dimensions to it that no one had explored before.
In the acknowledgments of Seabiscuit, you write that writing the book was a lesson in how history hides in curious places. And you said the story was tucked in back pockets and bottom drawers. What are some of the interesting places that you found remnants of the Seabiscuit story?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, one sort of imagines an author going to a library and getting everything they need there or doing some interviews. And for me, I did all those things, and I did more than 100 interviews, and those things were really wonderful. But the story was in very strange places. I actually would go to eBay every day and type in Seabiscuit's name and the name of the names of the other individuals in the story and just see what I got. And I was just periodically buying things. And I typed in the name George Wolfe, which was, George was, in my mind, perhaps the greatest jockey who ever lived. He rode Seabiscuit when Red Pollard, his other jockey, was injured, which was all the time. And I typed in his name, and I got a link to a porn magazine from 1951. And it was, I think it was only $2.50, and I thought, I have to know how George Wolfe made it into a porn magazine. So I bought the magazine, and it's a horrible, horrible magazine. It couldn't be worse, and it's really not much in terms of pornography either. But there was a story in there that was oddly very well written and very well researched about George, just his personality and stories about his life. And I called up the people I knew, these very elderly men who had been George's friends back in the 30s, and asked them about these stories, including one story in which George had been riding in a race at the racetrack at Tijuana and had actually ridden right out of his pants and had been wearing nothing underneath. He had torn through them and rode a winner naked from the waist down. And I called up his friends, and they said, I remember that. And one of them had actually been riding in that very same race. And all the stories checked out. It was a wonderful story about George, and I couldn't believe I'd found all this information in a porn magazine.
How did you manage to do 100 interviews when you were hardly able to leave your house?
I did all of my interviews from home. I never met any of my sources in person, which I would love to have done, but I simply couldn't. Although a number of them, virtually all my sources were in their 80s or 90s. One man was 100 years old and lived in a trailer in the desert with no telephone. I had to reach him through somebody else. And some of them I couldn't have reached anyway, but it was via telephone just about entirely. And it was wonderful because I had a lot of time to work on the book. I spent 4 years on it, and I developed terrific friendships with a lot of these people. Unfortunately, about 12 of them have now died. Nearly all of them got a chance to see their stories in print, which was nice.
Laura Hillenbrand is the author of Seabiscuit, a new edition illustrated with photographs, has just been published to coincide with the release of the new movie. We'll hear more from Hillenbrand in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Laura Hillenbrand about writing the book Seabiscuit. Then we'll talk with her editor, Jonathan Karp. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Laura Hillenbrand, the author of the book Seabiscuit. To coincide with the new film adaptation, there's a new illustrated edition of the book that includes about 150 photographs from archives and private collections. Hillenbrand has an extreme case of chronic fatigue syndrome, which makes it difficult for her to leave home, so we talked to her by phone. What was it like trying to do the writing part with chronic fatigue syndrome?
That was very difficult. Because of the misleading name of chronic fatigue syndrome, people think it's just fatigue. And exhaustion is a very big part of this disease, but there are a lot of other serious symptoms, among them neurological ones. And for me, for a lot of people, balance disorders are a big problem with CFS. For me, it's a severe problem. And I have vertigo, which means that the room appears to be moving up and down or from side to side all the time. Things appear to be flexing and bending, and the walls seem to fold and unfold. And at times it's very bad, and it's very disorienting. And reading and writing makes it much worse. And so obviously I was having to read and write a great deal in working on the book, and I was having to work around it as much as I could. At times I simply could not write. The room was spinning too much. I couldn't do it. So I would get on my back in my bed with a pad and close my eyes and just write on the pad. And I would write right over the line I'd written before, but at least I was getting something on paper. It was difficult to work in terms of being able to get to material I needed. I had a lot of things requisitioned from the Library of Congress because I couldn't get there, even though I live in Washington, D.C., very close to the Library of Congress. I would take out all the books I would need to research in a particular day or week, and I would put them in a horseshoe shape around my desk so that I wouldn't have to get up. And sometimes I just sit on the floor with them to move through them so I wouldn't have to keep pulling books up and down. And we actually jerry-rigged a device to hold the text that I was reading upright because I have trouble looking down. My vertigo gets a lot worse then. So I had to do a lot of odd things. And also in terms of dealing with my exhaustion, I basically cut everything else out of my life but working on this book, and I even went so far as to put a refrigerator in my office so that I wouldn't have to walk down the stairs to eat. I could just eat while I worked. And I pushed myself too hard beyond what I really could stand, and the day after I turned in the book, my health collapsed completely. But I have to say it was worth it because I had four blissful years living with these people in 1938.
You describe them as blissful years, but considering how difficult the actual writing process was, where was the pleasure?
The pleasure was in the moments that I lost myself in the work. I became so engrossed that I would forget my body, and it was the first time, I've had this disease for 16 years, and it was the first time I had really become so involved in something that I would be unaware of what was happening to my body and how much I was struggling through. And I really escaped myself in this story. It's a very dramatic story. It's a story full of motion and activity. The individuals are very dynamic in it, and it's the polar opposite of my life, which is very, very still. And so that was the real pleasure in it, was getting to the end of the day and realizing I hadn't been focusing on my body all day, that I'd been telling a story instead. It redefined me. I became a different person with a different purpose.
Now, what about your editor? I have to say, if I were an editor and somebody brought me the outline for a book and said, this promises to be a terrific book, but I should warn you that the person writing it has a very bad case of chronic fatigue syndrome, and usually the walls look like they're bending and the room is spinning around, so it might take a while for her to finish the book. I'd be pretty skeptical that this book would ever be finished.
You'd really have to ask him. He really never acted like he doubted me. He gave me all the room in the world. He let me turn in the first piece of work that I turned into him rather late in the game. I was so worried about it being perfect that I wouldn't let him see anything until I really had the whole thing done. He really let me work the way I wanted to work, and I don't know that he did worry about it. He never indicated that he did. And I pretty much promised him at the beginning, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get this done. And I promised myself, and I thought, if I have to kill myself, I'm going to get this thing done. It matters that much to me.
What were some of the most helpful suggestions he gave you about the actual structure of the book?
We didn't talk a huge amount about that. The one place that we really talked about a lot was how to start the book. And that was the most difficult decision I had to make. I had four main characters, all of whom needed very complicated backgrounds written, and I needed to know how to get it off on the right foot. I tried many different things, and he said, look, let's just be really simple. Let's do a preface in which we talk about the impact that this horse ended up having on America. Let's talk about how he was the number one newsmaker in America by newspaper column inches in 1938, and let's explain why, just very briefly, and then just walk into the story. And I fought him on it, but he was exactly right. This was the way we should have started the book.
I'll read the opening sentence. I have the book right here, and this is the opening sentence from the preface. In 1938, near the end of a decade of monumental turmoil, the year's number one newsmaker was not Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Hitler, or Mussolini. It wasn't Pope Pius XI, nor was it Lou Gehrig, Howard Hughes, or Clark Gable. The subject of the most newspaper column inches in 1938 wasn't even a person. It was an undersized, crooked-legged racehorse named Seabiscuit. That's actually the first paragraph, not just the first sentence. that is effective.
It's the most descriptive thing about him. It says so much about how huge the horse was that he was able to command that much attention from the press.
My guest is Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller Seabiscuit. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Laura Hillenbrand, author of the bestseller Seabiscuit, which has been adapted into a new film. Very recently, you had a piece in The New Yorker that was about your illness. And, oh, God, it just sounded horrible. I mean, you had doctors who not only misdiagnosed you and condescended to you. There was one doctor who said, okay, you have chronic fatigue syndrome. Then he told you he had chronic fatigue syndrome. Then everyone in his office told you that he had diagnosed them as having chronic fatigue syndrome, too, which kind of casts a doubt on the diagnosis.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you have good medical care now?
I do. I ended up getting my definitive diagnosis from the head of infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins. You can't do any better than that. And I have since, that was many years ago, that was 16 years ago, and I now, a lot more is understood about the illness. I have a pretty classic case. It's a severe case, but it's pretty classic, and so we're certain about the diagnosis. What's difficult is there's very, very little that can be done for me. The cause of the illness is not very well understood yet. It has gotten so little funding. It's more common than multiple sclerosis or AIDS in this country, but it doesn't get anywhere near the money. And so the level of understanding creeps forward at a very, very petty pace.
Why did you decide to write the article for The New Yorker?
I had been through a terrible first year with the disease, not only because I was rendered completely bedridden and dropped to 100 pounds and thought I was losing my life, but also because I could not get competent medical care. I could not get people in my personal life or in terms of doctors to take it seriously. And I wanted the public to understand what this disease is. People still have no idea. When I meet people and they say, well, I heard you have CFS, they really don't have any concept of what that is. And they, because of the name, they tend to greatly underestimate what it is. And that has an impact on the lives of patients, because we, a lot of times we need some consideration from people to just get around outside and things like that. And you certainly don't need to be derided, which a lot of us have been. So I wrote it to give one patient's perspective on what this disease is and what happens to you when you have this, because no one had really done that before in a big publication, and I was very grateful to The New Yorker for letting me write a big, thorough piece on it.
You know, in your New Yorker article about your illness, you described the onset of it, which was, it was sudden. It was like a flash of lightning sudden. Why don't you describe what happened?
It was extremely surreal. I was an athletic person. I was a straight-A student. I had swum competitively for 10 years. I was very happy. I was at college. I was 19 years old, and doing quite well, and you know, had a big future ahead of me, I thought. And I was coming back from spring break in March of 1987. I was in a car with my best friend, Lincoln, and my boyfriend, Borden, in the back. I was sitting in the passenger seat, and it was very dark on the road, and I saw ahead of me, materializing in front of me, an enormous deer on the side of the road looking our way. And we were going pretty quickly, and I just had time to see him lift his knee up to step into the road in front of us. And I just had time to suck in my breath, thinking he was going to step in front of the car and roll up the windshield and kill me. And we went past him. He didn't bend his knee all the way. He didn't step into the road. And we passed him. And I was trying to begin to react to that when something else caught my eye. And it was a meteor going straight over the car ahead of us, from behind us to ahead of us, and it plunged straight into the horizon directly ahead of us. And I don't know how many times I've seen a meteor, but I've never seen one like that. And I just let out my breath and turned to Lincoln, my friend, and I was going to talk about it, but I realized he hadn't even seen either thing. He hadn't seen the deer or the meteor. I looked back to Borden in the back seat. He hadn't seen them either. And I was going to say something when I realized all of a sudden I felt terribly sick. I felt very sick to my stomach. I felt feverish. I felt exhausted. And so I never said a word about the deer or the meteor. And by the time we got back to campus, I was doubled over. My boyfriend called paramedics. 2 weeks later, I woke up and was unable to even sit up in bed. And my life has never been the same since.
Do you think it's possible that the meteor and the deer were actually fever hallucinations?
I wonder about that. I actually forgot all about them that night, because I became very, very sick that night. And then I was quite sick for a few weeks before really plunging fully into the CFS and being unable to get up and having to drop out of college. And I kind of remembered it later and thought, boy, yeah, those two things happened one after the other. They've become metaphoric to me because I ended up for a number of years being completely bedbound. At times I was unable to roll myself over in bed or speak or feed myself. And I had vertigo, which was making the room whirl around me violently day and night. Even my dreams took place on pitching ships. And I began to believe that I had hit the deer that night and that I'd been killed and I was in hell. And it wasn't that I was thinking metaphorically at the time. I believed I must have actually been in hell because it was so bad. But I do wonder if they were real or if it was some kind of, I don't know, psychological harbinger of what was happening to my body.
You know, a lot of writers on Fresh Air talk about how different the process of writing a book is from the process of releasing the book to the public. You know, writing it, you're alone. It's just like you and the computer or you and the pad. And then when the book is public and you're connecting, you're like doing signings or interviews, it's a very public process that's completely the opposite of the actual process of doing the work. Although you haven't been able to leave the house a whole lot to do the book, it's still, you know, so extraordinarily different to have the book go public because you were so cloistered and even bedridden during the most of the process of actually writing it. Can you talk a little bit about that contrast of being homesick, writing the book, and then having the book take on a public life?
Sure. It has been very strange. The process of writing the book was very consistent with the rest of my life. It was solitary and kind of intense. And, you know, I was alone with my subjects all the time and for years on end. And that's pretty much what I had been doing prior to writing this book. I was writing articles, and it was a lot like that. I mean, other than breaking this solitary life with interviews, it was pretty much something done alone. And then the book came out, and it was in 5 days it hit the bestseller list, and all of a sudden there were people calling all the time and letters coming in, and I was needing to go on. The first thing I did was go on NBC Nightly News, and this is somebody, I was somebody who'd been alone in my bedroom for years. It was stunning. It was like falling out of an airplane. It was such a different experience. And I still feel kind of stunned all the time. It feels very strange to hear people discussing my work and to have the story be retold and just the intense public exposure. I've done about, I think I'm coming up on 300 interviews now. And it's all very strange. It's very, very different. It's nice different for the most part. I when you're a writer, you want to be read, and I've certainly been very fortunate that way. And I love that these individuals that I wrote about are famous again, because I think they deserve it. I think they ought to be remembered.
What do you think of the casting of Seabiscuit? The horse himself.
Seabiscuit is actually being played by 16 different horses.
No, really?
Because Seabiscuit himself was a very complicated character. He has as complicated a personality as anyone else in the story. And he also went through a lot of character transformation over the course of the story because he's handled by different people who treat him differently. So what they needed to do was they needed to get one horse who was trained to lie down a lot because Seabiscuit was an emphatic sleeper. They needed to get another horse who was very combative because there was a period of time in which Seabiscuit really was losing his marbles with his first trainer and was very difficult. You needed slow ones and fast ones to depict different races. So it was a lot of different horses. I believe there was a main horse named Fighting Ferrari who played him for a lot of it, and Toby McGuire, who plays Red Pollard, rode him a lot. But it all works. I mean, you can't tell that it's different horses in different scenes.
I want to wish you congratulations on the success of the whole Seabiscuit story, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I've had a lovely time.
Laura Hillenbrand is the author of Seabiscuit. A new edition, illustrated with photographs, has just been published to coincide with the release of the new movie. That's Livery Stable Blues. Coming up, we hear from the editor of the book Seabiscuit, Jonathan Karp. This is Fresh Air. When I was talking with Laura Hillenbrand about writing Seabiscuit while suffering with chronic fatigue syndrome, I was thinking about what the experience was like for her editor. So we invited her editor, Jonathan Karp, to talk with us. Seabiscuit isn't his first book that was made into a film. He edited The Orchid Thief, which was a longtime nonfiction bestseller and inspired the film adaptation. In Karp's 14 years at Random House, he's also edited books by Poe Bronson, Christopher Buckley, Dale Bumpers, David Frum, Gary Hart, Howard Kurtz, John McCain, Dick Morris, Kenneth Pollack, Mario Puzo, Paul Wellstone, and Paul Watkins. Well, talking to Laura and reading her New Yorker piece, I couldn't help but wonder, why would an editor take a chance on an author who was so sick and could rarely leave her bed. Did you have a lot of reservations about signing the book, Seabiscuit?
Well, I guess my first comment would be to quote the movie and just say you don't throw someone out just because they're beat up a little bit. But the fuller answer is that the proposal that we received from Laura's agent, a very dynamic and well-regarded literary agent named Tina Bennett, was so superb that we just had faith in Laura's ability to write the book. We knew that she had chronic fatigue syndrome, but to be honest, I really didn't have a very good idea of just how serious the illness was. And my feeling was if she'd been able to write about horse racing for 10 years and win awards, which she had been able to do, she'd be able to write the book. So I didn't really overthink it.
How did you find out how serious it really was?
Over time, I went to visit her at her house. We had a great conversation. We talked about the editing, and she was still writing the book at that point. And I called her the next day, and I said, you know, Laura, I would never know you were sick. And she said, well, I was seeing two of you during the whole time. I really didn't realize how serious it was.
Now, what impressed you about the early portions of Seabiscuit that you were shown by Laura Hillenbrand's agent?
Well, I think that the proposal had the contours of a great story. And I keep thinking of what Bernard Malamud said about what really good fiction writing is about. He said it was story, story, story. And Seabiscuit is architecturally a perfect story. It has protagonists overcoming adversity in a very unexpected way, and they keep surprising you with their ability to surmount the odds. So I had faith that the story, if it were told well, would have an elemental power to it. Then Laura herself took it leaps further by writing it with a great deal of lyricism and intensity and passion.
Now, she says that you came up with the beginning of the book because she was having a hard time figuring out what the beginning should be. How did you come up with it?
Well, the truth of it is, I first got interested in the book because I was having lunch with Laura's agent, Tina Bennett, and Tina mentioned the Seabiscuit proposal to me. And I said, you know, I'm not really interested in horses or horse racing. And Tina said, well, you know, this was no ordinary horse. In 1938, more was written about this horse than FDR or Mussolini or Hitler. And that's actually in the book. And that's how the book now begins, because that was what got me interested in it. And then I figured if I was interested in that fact, then other readers would be as well.
When you signed Seabiscuit, when you signed the book, did you think this is going to be a big book, this is a big bestseller, or did you think more this will be more like the prestige book, it's a very literary nonfiction book, it's not going to sell a lot, but I'll be proud to have edited it, and the company will be proud to have published it?
When I signed the book up, all I knew was that it was a really good story with the potential to reach a large audience by a writer whose talent intrigued me. When Laura went away to write the book, I still didn't know. When we were meeting to discuss the book, I still didn't know. All I could really discern was that she really cared about this story a great deal. I remember her calling me with excitement, having found out some details about the Tijuana whorehouse that the jockeys visited, and the scrapbooks that the Howard family had let her borrow. And I knew that she really had a feeling for this subject. It seems to me that the key to success with any book is to have an author who's obsessed and who has the focus to see it through and then has the talent to deliver on it. And Laura had all of that. I think that it's funny, you asked me about how the chronic fatigue syndrome contributed to the book. And in a way, I think that it gave her a focus that perhaps some other authors never really achieve in their writing, because she was basically at home all the time with this book as the chief focus of her life. I think that she wrote it better.
Nonfiction writing has an obligation to accurately reflect the truth. often in magazines, certainly at the top magazines, there are fact-checking departments that check every fact in a nonfiction magazine article and make sure that it's accurate. I think it's much more difficult for book publishing companies to fact-check each fact in a book. I mean, I don't think book publishing companies do that. What do you consider your responsibilities as the editor of a nonfiction book to be able to vouch for the accuracy of the history and the facts within it?
Well, the publisher is going on faith when a book is signed up. And actually, there's a clause in the contract, a warranty clause, in which the author guarantees that the work will be accurate. So really, the most important decision I make as an editor is believing that the writer is good enough to get it right. And I just had a feeling that Laura would get it right. So that was my biggest and most important decision. Beyond that, as the first reader of the book, what you do is you just try to apply as much skepticism as you can. I remember that one of the concerns I had when I was reading the book was whether there was any kind of anthropomorphism going on, whether she was attributing too much intelligence or charm to Seabiscuit. And I was querying that very specifically, and in every instance, Laura backed it up and supported it and said, actually, Seabiscuit really was that intelligent and Seabiscuit really was that competitive. She actually wrote about how a lot of horses are competitive that way, that when they lose their riders during races, they almost always try to win anyway. And that's the kind of thing that I would never have known since I've never been to the track. But Laura was able to back up.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
And congratulations on the success of Seabiscuit.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jonathan Karp edited the bestseller Seabiscuit. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Roberta Shurrock, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacourt Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Hunting Midnight, a historical mystery from Richard Zimler, the author of The Last Kabbalist of Lisbon.